Thank you all for coming. This is a little far removed from the other sessions I've been in at LISA, but hopefully it will be entertaining. I will be making my slides available, hopefully, but I need to vet them by the studio first. So I was working on Prince Caspian. It was based in Prague in the Czech Republic. It's, I believe, the largest film that's ever been produced there. This is also the first time I've presented at LISA, so bear with me. There will be some film-specific terminology that I will try to provide background for as we go along. If I miss something, just catch me during the questions. So I was working with a team, mainly four people, myself. This gentleman here, Duncan Nemo, he did IT on all of the Lord of the Rings movies with Peter Jackson, as well as on the first Narnia movie. This guy, Paul Picorni, he was our network guy mainly. And this is our PA, Kaka Galava. We picked up some more people along the way, but that's the core team. I just want to warn you, this is the only movie I've ever worked in, so I may say something like about the movie industry and just take it with a grain of salt. When we started out in pre-production, when I was hired, there were about 25 or 30 people, mainly producers, writers, and art director type folks. We were based right off of Old Town Square in Prague in a top secret location where all the tourists walk by. And we were in this building, which is a Renaissance era building with, it had great big, like 20 foot tall posters outside that said Prince Caspian with like the logo. It was totally top secret. We had a lot of fun with that building. The walls were constructed in the Renaissance, and we couldn't put holes through them. They were like 3 meters thick. In December, we had built up sort of a core team of about 70 people. Again, artists, and then at this point, we had some of the main editors, as well as previs guys on board. They were doing early renderings of certain key scenes and elements from the film using technology similar to a Quake engine. So they would sort of create these character mock-ups, work with the art department, work with the script people and the director to sort of formulate how they were going to design the sets and shoot sequences. At Christmas time, like the day before Christmas, we had to ship half of the production to New Zealand. At this point, I guess it's appropriate to tell you about the server hardware that we had. We had a 5-year-old Apple slot loading XServe with 3 drives configured in a striped array when I showed up. And obviously, we weren't too happy about that. I was told by Duncan that we were supposed to be getting like a container load of equipment from Walden. So I pictured like a seaborne container with high quality switches and servers and sort of network attached storage and backup system and all the stuff you'd figure like they would just drop in. But that really wasn't the case. What we got was one more XServe and a couple of X-rays and a fiber channel switch. And we made the movie with it. So, New Zealand. We had to ship half of our people to New Zealand, and at the same time, we had to move everybody else down to the Berendorf Studios about 25 miles outside of Prague. At the same time, there was no network cabling at the Berendorf Studios, so Katka, the Czech PA who I pointed out, and Paul, they pulled about 8 kilometers of cable in about a month and a half, drilling holes in the walls. And then, so New Zealand, I can't really give you a lot of insight into what went on down there because there were some IT guys who handled the New Zealand leg of the production. My main interaction with them was just coordinating things in terms of user ads and like migrating data back and forth and conference calls late at night. One interesting thing, one of the senior studio folks had a penchant for hot popcorn, and right before we were about to ship one of the servers down to New Zealand, we were making a backup, and we pulled the, because our network infrastructure was shitty, we pulled the fiber channel off, put it on a switch, and we're backing it up to the other server, and we had these power cords kind of strung through the halls. We were running a skeleton staff because it was Christmas Eve. And this producer kind of guy comes along in the middle of the night and like unplugs all of our stuff, midpoint through the copy, and plugs in a popcorn machine. So we came in the next day and we were like, oh, what the hell? Our calculations indicated this copy would be complete. Anyway, we got it down there all right. So Barrandov Studios were constructed mainly during the 1920s and 30s, during the first period of Czechoslovak independence. They were expanded by the Nazis, lots of Nazi slave labor, and a lot of propaganda films were made there over the years. This is an overhead view. It's, I don't know, probably 10,000 feet. You can see it's a pretty big complex. A lot of the set construction happened here in this back lot. This was one of the main buildings here. There's a new studio that Google Maps doesn't reflect. It's the largest studio in Europe. It sits right there. And then we had sort of the editors and producers housed there. They kind of like to drop buildings in on us. So throughout the course of the production, we would find out, like, oh, you know that building they've been building? That's for so-and-so, and it needs to have connectivity on Monday. So we had a lot of reactive stuff like that. This is a memorial to the victims who died during the construction of the studios. Here's a view of the old studio, Strizhny. And this is the new Studio Max, which was completed immediately prior to us moving into Barrandov, but they didn't put in any cabling, and they wouldn't allow us to run any cabling, so we had to do lots of wireless bridges, and then run Cat5 like through fire escape doors, and it was just nasty. Another building. This is set under construction. This was a Vin Diesel movie that was going on the same time we were there. And this is the beginning of the construction of one of the main sets on the movie. Here it is farther along. I can't show you the actual set, but this is sort of a stripped-down base camp. There would usually be about 10 more tents and a bunch of trailers. But we were required to provide access, internet access, as well as local net access to the base camp wherever it moved. So as they were, well, they moved like almost every day. So wireless antenna. What you can see here, this is kind of amusing. This is a big panel of lights that they used. It was up on a crane. That was for night shoots. And there you can see from a distance, they were in full on night production there. And again, this is from the grocery store down the street. You can see how top secret it is. Like, it was kind of funny. I would go walking with my dog on lunch break, and there were these safflower fields right here behind the back lot. And routinely, I would find like huge masses of power cables and stuff just laying back there with the copper stripped out. I guess it was in the budget. The first location that I went to was in Bledno Skale. This is in Poland. I don't have a lot of pictures from that, but you can see an image of base camp. We didn't have enough time to provision internet access there, but what we did a lot on the film was, this was Paul Picorni's idea, CDMA modem, Wi-Fi access point, drop them in a weatherproof box, hand it to whoever needs it, and we had about 16 of these. And they provided an enormous amount of connectivity on the film. And as a matter of fact, we were lucky because we were just close enough to the Czech border that it worked. So it was nice. Our main set was in Ústí nad Labem, a little village called Nezná Bohy, which literally means the place God does not know. And I think if you talk to anybody who spent their summer in Ústí, they would agree. So here you can see the approach. Desolate area. There's a full base camp. Fortunately, we were just within line of sight of a microwave tower up on a mountain, so we were able to get like an 8-meg symmetric circuit in there. It was a whole lot cheaper than satellite, and that's what we did. This base camp went through a number of reconfigurations. In fact, it was
constantly being reconfigured. And we had, like, if you look right here, this is roughly where the IT trailer was when we got a trailer. And then we had, like, cabling running through here. And then we had antennas that we would move around here depending on where they shifted the cast trailers and where they put makeup that week. And then we had a bunch of access points interconnecting through here as well as the main set, which was like over here. So we had a series of wireless bridges that went through the woods over that, which were moved on a semi-weekly basis. This is my office in the beginning. They gave us a pop-up tent. That's my dog, Nadia. And what you can see right here, this is the trailer. Up here is the microwave antenna, going down to that. And this is like some of the our switching hardware is in here. We've got a battery, extra UPS, and a bench. Now, it was summertime, and there were thunderstorms all the time. So whenever it would start to rain, I would have to gather up all this equipment, shut everything down, haul it all the way across the set, drop it in the producer's trailer, which they kindly let me use because they didn't want to pay for all of this stuff again, and then go around and pull down all the wireless masks so they wouldn't, like, blow up everything. It was really awesome. So after a while, they got tired of us moving our stuff into their trailer, and they gave us our own, which you can see. This guy right here is Mark. He's one of the sort of engineering student Rasta guys who we got to work with us. He was very helpful. He pulls cable faster than anybody I've ever seen. And there's the interior of our workspace. Here are a few more pictures. You can see one of the masks there. This is where visual effects were working. It was not an air-conditioned space. Here you can see this is a PoE injector with some Czech Wi-Fi gear that we got, and we put it in weatherproof boxes, and that was our thing until we got some better gear. This is where everybody stayed. It's a communist-era hotel, the Hotel May. Also, great connectivity there. We use those CDMA access points for connectivity in the hotels to a certain extent, where the cast would stay, because the cast were really, really important. We would sometimes bring in satellite shots just for them, despite the expense, because they wanted to Skype with their friends at home, which is important. So one of the things that's different about the film industry is this notion of a box rental. In your normal corporation, you've got like your Suns, your HPs, whatever, you're kind of standardized across. Maybe you've got some Macs in the art department, I don't know. Well, everybody brings their own equipment. So at the beginning, like, they hire an art director. The art director turns around and hires, like, an assistant and a secretary who he's worked with before, and they recommend other people. And there's this sort of a tree. People who people have worked with before get hired underneath. Does that make sense? So you get hired on. You make a deal. You get a deal memo. This is, like, how you are compensated throughout the end of the production. There's no negotiation on this. It's a one-time deal. And as part of that, you have a box rental. Basically, you are providing your own tools. So if you're a sound engineer, you're bringing your own soundboard. If you are a video editor, you're bringing your own Avid suite. And you're sort of required to maintain these. Unfortunately, with a total crew of about five or 600 people and three of us, the crew didn't really see it that way. They wanted us to support their boxes. And we had everything from Mac OS 9, to Vista, and everything in between, variants of Linux, and running in Italian, German, Polish, Czech, Slovak, Slovenian, English. That's all I can think of. So it was a good test of muscle memory sometimes. Here you can see a laptop. This one particular guy, who I won't name, he was a little crazy, and this was not the only laptop that got dropped down multiple flights of stairs. Some people tried to play the system, and they would bring in old hardware, and then it would have accidents, and they would convince the production to replace it. It happened too much. But not for me. Power. Power was fun, no matter where we were. I showed you that microwave trailer up in Ustie. one of the fun things that happened was the electricians came in on a weekend and they kind of moved some things around. And then we get a phone call from the ISP and he's like, I need to come in there and have a look. My temperature sensors are off the scale. Well, what had happened was they had just inverted the power. So instead of like pulling hot air out, it was pumping hot air into the trailer. That was cool. We routinely lost power to entire floors at Berendorf. Wasn't very successful in convincing anybody to unask the money for surge protection. We did keep our servers up with some hefty UPSs. Interestingly, the video editing is done on these systems called Avids. They're very high-end, expensive Windows boxes with fiber channel storage. So they have this system called Avid Unity, which is like a god-awful expensive instance of Server 2003 with some custom extensions. And they brought in, there's this consulting firm, they brought in the Unity system, all of this storage, and they acted like rock stars. They moved things around in our server room without asking us. They like unplugged things. They were generally dicks and incompetent, but they had brought over 110 volt UPSs for all of their gear. So the solution to this was not to actually go out and get appropriate backup power, but to put everything on these cheap $20 Chinese made power converters that were like bing. So our running joke was like to go in, flip the circuit, and then watch as everything fried. I'll have more to say about the Unity system later. There's that. Kind of tangential power issue. This right here is a lightning rod. And that is a large cage for butane tanks. The safety guys didn't catch it, but as the IT guys, we sort of felt safe stepping outside of our boundaries. No one stole the butane cage, by the way. Yes, that's the point. Isn't that awesome? And that was right outside of the wardrobe facility. They were the sweetest people in the entire movie, and I would have hated to see them go sky high. So, networking. When we started out the movie in that sort of Renaissance era building I showed you, there were a variety of sort of like switches and hubs chained together with gaffer tape running up and down stairs and over the walls, and it was terrible. So one of the first things I did was to get in some managed switches. I thought we were building a network for like 60 to 80 people, so we put our core on some sort of low-end Linksys managed switches, which were great for a while. Here you can see some of the Rasta engineering students pulling cable. Like I said, they pulled about 8 kilometers in the Berendorf buildings, not to mention the untold amount of cable that got pulled on set. Big, thick walls built by the Nazis. All around the studio compound, there were these sort of like bunkers that were kind of inside of cages, but you could tell that it was left over from World War II. And we also had a bunch of fiber running through these tunnels that were built between the studio buildings. That was nice. So the switches. By the time I left, we had at least 600 people running, and our core switch was a $250 Linksys managed switch, and it would melt down, predictably. We were not able to figure out exactly what happened. It was not firmware corruption. It was just like the switching fabric would melt every 2 weeks. And so we kept a whole stack of these switches configured because we couldn't convince, well, you know, the studio is in the business of making a movie. They're not in the business of having IT. I mean, everything we build, it's all going away in a couple of months. So it's kind of hard to make an argument to go out and spend $15,000 on some appropriate switching gear when, you know, you can just keep replacing them every 2 weeks. So that's that. Satellite links. Like I said, we did pull some in. We spent an awful lot of time worrying about it because they kept telling us, no, we're not going to need any satellite. no, not going to need any satellite, but it takes a lot of lead time to get like a dedicated symmetric circuit that'll roam around.
Wireless. It was a lot of wireless. This is sort of our standard stock here. We got these, which were improved.
We had a big problem with heat. So these were $80 check made Wi-Fi access points, but they were still melting.
So Nick, who came on just as I was leaving and is now working with post-production, he, as in like his first day, he looks at these things and he goes, ah. That right there is like a $4 heatsink. And that bought us some time until we could actually talk the production into purchasing some decent gear. What can I say?
Right here, that is garden hose. We use that as conduit because you see this grass out here where all the cars are parked? That got really, really muddy. It got so muddy that it would be like this deep of mud. And you have these big guys in armor who are supposed to be walking around, and like they can't be walking through 12 inches of mud. So periodically they would come in with bulldozers and just bulldoze out all this mud. But they would never check with us and find where our cable path was. So this was an attempt to ameliorate that. We still wound up pulling a lot of cable. Here you can see a wireless mast. This is toward the end when we got some decent stuff. This is closer to the beginning. All right, so. This guy, Paul Picorni, who I worked with, the bald guy who I showed you at first, he is just a master jewelry rigger. And he was tasked with going and like doing all the cabling and firing up the network at Berendorf, and then after that, we put him on the task of getting ready for this big Ustie location. So he went out there and set up all these masts, and he did all of these diagrams, and he knew how everything was going to be until it changed. But there was no electricity out there, and we needed to be able to test. So we did. He managed to hook everything into his car battery, and that was really impressive. I told you already about these. It's amazing how much of this movie got shoved through CDMA modems. It's not even funny. Data recovery. This is a good story. So one of the guys who would be listed in the top five names in the credits dropped his laptop. Maybe he didn't drop his laptop. At any rate, right before Christmas, he came to us and he's like, oh my God, I have all of these locations, scouting things on here, and you know, they've been traveling around Europe for weeks by helicopter, finding these locations, and they had all these pictures, and it just dropped. Well, so we called around and found some data recovery center, and they had a great price, and I was thinking, man, I need to like advertise this Czech data recovery service on the mailing list. It's so cheap. And sent his disc off. Everything was very professional. And then he went away for Christmas, and then he went down to New Zealand, and then he came back like in April or May, and we'd been having some problems in the meantime, so it hadn't really been on the forefront of our minds. So he comes back and he's like, hey, what's up with my disc? And we start calling around, and come to find out the entire data recovery company had been seized by the Czech police, and his drive was there. It took us like 6 months to get it back, and it involved like sending our PA down there to meet with a secretary who worked for the police and like give her a bottle of rum or something. So I told you already something about Previz. How am I doing on time? Okay. Editorial, Previz, and visual effects. They were all kind of butted together. We built them a special secure corridor with thumbprint scanners and very incestuous relationships. So they go out, they shoot the film, Then they send it off to be digitized. It's still shot on analog film. I'm not an editor, but somehow they do the editing on the digital machines, but then it gets cut. I don't know how that all works. What am I trying to say here? Previz has to alter what they're doing based upon how the previous day's take went. And visual effects has to be ordering in like all of these different elements. Like, say they need to have like some kind of shattered glass element where somebody breaks a window. They're tracking all of these things, and as you're shooting, sorry, you shook your head. As they're shooting a scene and trying to like get it finalized, there's a whole lot of sort of cyclical feedback from one of these departments to another, if that makes sense. Maybe it doesn't. Next slide. Aspera. Has anybody ever heard of Aspera? One person? Two people? So Aspera is basically a glorified SFTP server that blasts traffic over UDP really, really, really fast. And you pay for your licensing based on a certain guaranteed minimum transmission rate. So we had, at this point, I think we had about a 40 meg symmetric link, and they would, like somebody in editorial would fire up one of these Aspera transfers at 10 megs, and somebody over in visual effects would fire one up to LA at 10 megs, and like nobody would tell anybody. That was a lot of fun, and we could not get sort of the political capital to do any kind of QoS or bandwidth management. So sometimes we would just have to call around and say like, hey, you know what? The net's down for 2 hours. Video streaming. So video streaming is useful because when you have multiple units, you have the director working on one unit, usually second unit, aerial unit, third unit, whatever, they send their film out at night, it gets digitized, it goes to editorial the next day, they edit it, do a rough cut, sit down, they review that with visual effects and with previs, talk about how it went, and then based upon that feedback, second unit, aerial unit, whatever, they have to go and redo something. Well, video streaming is nice because you can actually let the director sit there and he can be on the phone with the second unit director, and in between takes on first unit, he can sit and say, okay, and they're shooting in second unit, and he can say, okay, stop, that's a wrap, that's good enough. This saved a lot of money. I mean, it saved days. And when you have all of these people, they're not poorly paid, a lot of them. If you can save a couple of days of shooting because the director can say cut at an appropriate point, that's great. Initially, we did this using, you're going to laugh even more. We had a Linux box running Darwin streaming server, and then we had a feed that we would get off of the sort of a camera mix guy, and then we'd run that through a Mac Mini to digitize it and upload it to this streaming server that worked pretty well for a while. The problem was that the quality wasn't always great on poor links. So we early on had been planning on building these fancy encoder boxes. Couldn't get the money. Later on, as the production became more dependent upon video streaming, they decided to buy them instead of building them like we wanted to. And what they bought were these boxes that were like $20,000 a piece, and it was running like 2003 again with some kind of encoder card and a little CGI interface. So you could put video in on one end, shoot it out the other. They were supposed to be optimized for satellite links and all kinds of high latency links. They weren't. So the last I heard, they were doing their video streaming over Skype because in the end, it had the best mixture of quality and bandwidth management. I told you you'd laugh. FileMaker Pro. Has anybody here ever had to work with FileMaker Pro? So the movie world is very Mac-centric, and they need to capture a lot of data, so FileMaker Pro is kind of a logical thing. Visual effects and editorial were the driving forces in this because there's a lot of metadata associated with scenes. Say you're going to do, I don't know, like a special feature on a DVD. So while you're doing a scene, you maybe go in and flag some other video footage as being a possible candidate for inclusion on a bonus feature. In visual effects, they're dealing with lots of different elements for one scene, and they're farming different elements out to different outside vendors for rendering or production. So they needed a way to track that. This FileMaker thing was a total nightmare. We went through so many developers, and it was like, bring them in. First of all, find a FileMaker developer who was local or who could somehow work with us and who was competent. Get them to sign the NDA. Try to get them up to speed on the concept. I mean, because it's kind of a specialized niche, visual effects, FileMaker development. Not a lot of those guys out there. And it was like, we went through about five. They would just decide we want another one. And we wound up kind of trying to stand between the developers and visual effects and manage sort of a software development process, which in the end burned us a bit. Schmuck. Schmuck in German, I think, means jewel. I don't think that's what my coworkers meant when they gave it this name. So when we moved everybody from Mal and Amnesty, that little place downtown, to Studio Berendorf, we realized, like, we're taking on staff at this rapid rate. We need to have some kind of control. And also, we thought security was a big thing that we should emphasize, because you've got instances of films, like clips appearing on YouTube, and that can cause havoc with the legal department at Studio and get people fired. So we were trying to find ways that we could alleviate that problem. Additionally, because we had eight buildings at the Berendorf Studio complex, we had terrible physical security. We were not able to get keys to any of the rooms. We weren't able to get a master key. So doors were being left unlocked, people were walking in and out, laptops were disappearing, and at the least we wanted to be able to have some kind of management, so if somebody walked up and plugged in to a port, they wouldn't be able to download the entire movie. So we built Schmuck, and it probably shouldn't have happened. So there's this tool called Django, which is a web development framework based in Python. It's great. You kind of define your data models, and it generates all of your database tables for you. It automatically gives you a very nice customizable administrative interface. You can do like access controls and, you know, have administrative users. So we said, all right, everybody has to be registered in Schmuck. So we would have different department heads who would put the people in, and then we would go around and we would collect information about their laptops and make sure that there was virus and blah, 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 put the MAC address in, and then that would feed into our access control system. This was awesome because we would have sometimes 30 or 40 people show up on one day, and we had no control over that. So by saying, hey, you may be having people showing up, but they're not going to have any access if you don't tell us in advance that they're showing up. The information we put in there, we'd have their cell phone number, we'd call them, make an appointment to go see them, and it was great. So we basically modeled the entire production organization within this system, and it wound up being like a phone book for us, because like everything is delivered in paper format on a movie. You have, like, they would publish three times a week a pamphlet this thick with all the contact information for the entire crew. That's like almost an inch. And you get like three of these a week for everybody. And they weren't always consistent, and it really wasn't convenient to carry. So by collecting the information here, we were able to do things like generate VCF and LDIF directories of the entire crew and put that on people's smartphones and do some cool stuff like that. We were able to see in advance when we got a ticket for such and such a person. We could go and say, oh, that laptop is in German. Well, let's send Paul because he's got the best German. There were lots of little things that were very helpful. So then there's this thing called a call sheet. Every single day, they put out a call sheet during production. This says what scene is going to be shot the next day, what time Everybody's supposed to report depending on whether you're in makeup. Maybe you have to be there at 4 in the morning. If you're the director, maybe you come in at 8. It says what the weather is supposed to be like. It says where the catering is going to be. There are all these details. Every single day, you get a call sheet. Sometimes the weather changes. Sometimes the plans change late at night. We needed a way to notify people. So using Noki, which is sort of an open source interface to a Nokia mobile phone, the information we had in Schmuck and a bunch of Python scripts I wrote and some procmail goodness, I was able to set up an interface so the production coordinator could notify on a per department basis, our per unit basis, our per location basis, our to everybody at once, like changes in the form of SMSs. And this was all sent out through a single $100 Nokia phone sitting in our server closet. But you can notify 1,600 people of a change in the schedule in the course of 2 hours instead of calling them, which was great. All of this was integrated with RT to some extent. That was a bonus. Staffing. We had a lot of trouble with staffing. As the production sort of swelled, we wound up bringing in the guys from New Zealand to help us out because it was just hard to find somebody local who was qualified, who would work for the salaries we were willing to pay, and who would do so knowing full well that they would work 16 hours a day or more, and their job would go away in 2 or 3 months, maybe less, maybe more. No way you'd know. Kind of hard to staff in those conditions in the Czech Republic and get somebody who can speak good English. I mentioned already that security was a concern. We fought it as best we could. There were no clips leaked during the time that I or any of our team worked there, as far as I know. And other than that, I can't say anything really good about how we did security. We tried. I mentioned already diversity of platforms. So there's no real need to go into that. Printers. The Czech production company. So there's like Walden Media, Disney. They're the two studios at the top. And then if you go to Poland, there's like a Polish business entity there. If you go to the Czech Republic, if you go to New Zealand, there are all these sort of, there's a tier of business entities. The Czech production company was more used to thinking in terms of like IT as, oh, we have some crew coming here to shoot some scenes from the new James Bond movie. They're going to be here doing locations for 6 weeks. They're going to have a small office set up here. So we'll bring in like the local Mac tech guy, and he'll help them with any problems on an on-call basis, which is not really the environment we were working in. So we fought them constantly over, printers, which is stupid. I hate printers, but they were like just... We would get phone calls for the first 3 months, like every couple of days. There's some printer we never heard of. It's like here. Why isn't it working? And by the time we finally got some degree of control around it, as in like saying to the production, no, we do IT, you don't. There were like 10 different printer vendors in our facility, and that made life hell. Storage. So I mentioned in the beginning that we had two Apple X-Rays. They had about 5 terabytes each. I'll talk about storage and backup at the same time. I'd never worked on a movie, but I figured it would probably generate terabytes. And early on, I wanted to have some feel for what kind of capacity we would need. And I also wanted to know how to back it up. So I started tracking disk growth. As we approached full, I started suggesting and screaming, like, why don't we buy a big disk pool, have the production pay for it, and bill it back to the departments based on quotas? It didn't happen. Instead, what happened was that the primary user of storage was Visual Effects, and we gave them a quote for, like, some very Mac-centric world, appropriate X-ray-based system for their needs. And then they wanted to see an alternative, so we showed them like some Linux-based RAID 5 storage servers. And we built them about 6.5 terabytes of Linux-based storage for, I don't know, $5,000-$6,000. They liked that, and they worked. They were used on location for collection of data. And I don't know what they did with them afterwards. Backup. Backup was such a headache. What I didn't know when I started trying to sell the idea of backup was that how it was purchased was as nearline storage. I didn't know until very late that there was about 8 terabytes of data I didn't know about for the HD Blue Wave special edition release of the first Narnia movie. So as I was trying to get a backup system in, we made the mistake of doing a purely tape backup system. I would never do that again. Well, one problem that we had was that we were committed to staying on a Mac server platform, so your options in that space in terms of software are quite limited. So we went with this French backup software. Apparently it backs up the whole Paris Metro system. I can't recommend it, and so I won't name it. But I had talked to someone who had done a film, and they had backed it all up on this, and I said, okay, that's good enough for me. But I needed some hardware that would work with it, and I couldn't seem to get anybody in the Czech Republic to talk to me. I identified a unit that looked like it would work well in the US, but I couldn't buy it in Europe. And this was really infuriating, because you have these sort of business entities with the same name in adjacent countries, and they don't talk to each other at all. It's like they're completely different companies. So eventually we did get a Fujitsu Siemens storage system that more or less met our backup needs. I would probably hire a consultant to take care of this in the future. So the Avid system that stored all of the digitally edited film that was running on those $20 power converters. Had a lot of storage, probably on the range of like 30, 35 terabytes, which to me is, I mean, not to some of you, but to me it's a lot of storage. And they didn't have a backup plan at all. And I mean, it wasn't really my area. I had no responsibility to editorial other than providing sort of secondary support. But it concerned me that these systems were running on such flaky power, and there was no concept of backing them up. I asked what their disaster recovery plan was, and it was to redigitize the film and recut it. And I was just like, well, what can I say to that? If you're happy, I may have misunderstood something that may not have been what was going on, but that certainly is the impression that I got. Here's one of those fancy systems here. You can see if you want to make more money, get certified on these, because you don't actually have to know much.
And they crash a lot.
Yeah. So, some silly stuff. Picture of my girlfriend. My dog. En flagrante delicto. Like I said earlier, movie studios aren't really in the business of doing system administration. They're not really in the business of managing data. They're in the business of making movies. And it's getting harder and harder these days to make money on movies because of piracy and the fact that they can't come up with very many original ideas. So they're turning to cost-cutting measures like making movies outside the US, not using union staff, using commodity hardware. We had a really hard time building an adequate system for them because we couldn't get the right information from the beginning. Like, we were supposedly building a network for 60 to 70, 80 people tops, and it wound up being closer to 500 or 600. We were told that the data set wouldn't grow, but, well, on The Lord of the Rings, on the production, I didn't work there, but this is what I've been told by Duncan Nemo, who did. This is how many people they had working on that production. First Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, 150. More than double. It was a big production. It would have been nice to know this up front. Now, and look, that's not a very high user count, right? 400. But imagine that you have like accounting, you have visual effects, you have art people, you have like editorial people. There are all these different little niches. They all speak different languages. They're running on completely different platforms that these people maintain themselves and bring with them. And you've got three people to support 400 of those guys. Like, it is a fairly tall order. A lot of FireWire drives were apparently used on The Lord of the Rings. The entire data set for Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe during production was a terabyte. And we handed off close to 13 terabytes at the end of Caspian. And how am I doing on time here? Because I have some backup stories. All right. So, there was this guy who did the popcorn thing. I've been pranked before, but I've never been pranked this bad. I told you how our switches were melting down. And we had Nagio set up, so we were getting pages and coming in the middle of the night and swapping out the switches and all this kind of stuff. And this was early on in the process of discovering that our switches sucked. So we were thinking, well, the switch can't just be melting. It's got to be something else. So we had all been in, like, all night long trying to debug the network. And the next morning, everything was working fine. And we were just sitting back having an espresso and a moment of zen. And we get this, my boss, Duncan, gets a phone call. It's this guy, the popcorn guy, who is very high up. And he says, hey, I know you guys have been having some problems lately. I've got this friend. He's a computer consultant in Texas, and he's going to be coming in and just looking at your processes for about a week. He'll be here on Monday, and I want you to provide him with any information that he needs. And it was like a real computer consultant from Texas. We get this email with this like real website listed and all of this stuff, and it was a total joke. So we're sitting there like just white, like, okay, we're being outsourced. This is awesome. And all of a sudden, I hear, like, well, I can't say what I heard, but it was like you, some piece of anatomy, just screamed over and over again. And I'm like, Duncan, oh, we're really, really fired, you know? And he's like, he's freaking joking. So that was, we never did come up with a good way to get back at him for that. When I was making my deal at the beginning, I went and talked to a production coordinator to negotiate my contract, and I said, hey, what about my box rental? You know, I have this fancy PowerBook here. If I'm leasing, I'd like to, you know, get something for it. Everybody else is. And she looked me dead in the eye, and she was like, why do you need a computer? You don't need a computer. You'll be working on other people's computers. That was the level of, well, we had to deal with people at that level pretty frequently. I mentioned that we shipped one of our servers over to, maybe I didn't mention, yeah, I think I did, over to New Zealand for the New Zealand leg of the production. It came in this really awful American-made road case, but our PA did a lot of rock shows as a rigger, and she knew this guy who made road cases. So we got some really nice road cases in floating foam for like $200 each. Beautiful. We all made love to them and sent the server off. And on the way back, the freight carrier like had a little accident and dropped the road case out of the plane. Like, I'm not kidding. So like we get a phone call. The Caspian server's here. You want to come pick it up? Okay. And this road case is just bashed. I'm like, holy crap. We had to, like, get a hacksaw to get the doors off. Fortunately, it had been backed up before shipment, but we got the doors off, and there's, like, all of these mounts, and they're just like, bing! It was amazing, but everything booted, no drive failures, nothing. So if any of you are looking for some hardened road cases, I can put you in contact. Let's see here. Not very pertinent to Lisa, but funny nevertheless, a couple of things. There were a lot of dwarves on the movie. That was a little weird. There was, like, during casting this one day when there were like 40 dwarves, and I have nothing to say against, I mean, people come in different sizes, and that's good, but it was a little bit weird, especially because there were like a couple of stripper dwarves who, I was like, what? It was just entertaining. The accountant called us up, the head accountant on the film called us up one day, and he's like, is there a hard limit to the number of rows you can have in Microsoft Excel? We're like, I think it's like 32,000 something. It's like, yeah, I've got 8 of these. Couldn't do anything to help him with that. What else? Da-da-da-da-da. Well, the last thing, there was this guy who had Tourette's. And
seriously?
It was a Disney movie. And there, it's mostly child actors. By the way, I will say about the child actors, like, they are all very, very cool people. I got to hang out with some of them, like, not cool in a, oh, you're an actor sense, but just surprisingly level-headed, considering what I would expect myself to be like making that kind of money and being a movie star at that age. Anyway, Tourette's guy was running around on set saying what you would imagine, and I don't know exactly why he was so good at what he did, but he didn't get fired. So I guess that's kind of it for storytelling conclusions. If you ever work on a film, press the production hard at the beginning to get a feel for the scope. And I guess that's all I have to say. Any questions?
I have a question. So after all of these riveting tales of pulling out miracles with a very small budget, would you do it again?
Now?
Yeah.
Kind of working on a contract right now for...
Well, I just meant in general.
Oh, in general? Right now? It's really boring, actually. I'm upgrading classrooms, but I get a security clearance out of it, so it's something to do for a while.
How does one find a job like this?
Accidentally? I was working with some guy who I knew who was a web developer, and he wanted me to do some kind of custom Drupal modules for a project he was working on, and I needed to make some money to go on vacation. So I started working with this guy, and I guess we didn't negotiate all that well at the beginning, and there was some friction, and then, like, right along about the point where I would have told him to go screw himself, I thought better of it, and I didn't. And things wound up nicely, and then 3 days after that project wrapped, he called me up and said, hey, I got a phone call about this movie project, and he didn't say anything about it, and he said, you know, can you go to such and such location on Monday and meet with a guy named Duncan? So I went, and it was kind of cool, because I really dug these books when I was a kid, and I had no idea that I would get to work on a movie like this. That's how you get this job. Just be lucky. That it? Well, I want to thank you all for coming. I realize probably you didn't learn anything that you will be able to take back and apply. And after this, I may never be able to work again, but thank you all for listening. I want to also thank Duncan Nemo, Paul Pokorny, Nick Brown, and Kat Kagalova for all they did. It was a team effort.